The theme of this series, Food and Society, and our first speaker in that is Franco Vaccarino, City Commissioner on More Than a Meal, The Social Power of Food. Now, Franco, fortunately for him, and I'll give a plug, another side issue of mine is oral history recording. And Franco very kindly did some recordings a while ago in which I found out quite a bit about him. He grew up in South Africa in an Italian family that spoke no English, but he learned English obviously there. He began working in a corporate bank where he set up literacy classes for staff. He later helped run family literacy projects and education in AIDS orphanages. He managed literacy programs in South African prisons, teaching hundreds of inmates. He also worked in Mozambique, designing adult education curricula. In 2003, he and his family migrated to Palmerston North. He joined Massey University in communication and adult literacy research and communication, where they had a fantastic seminar series there. And hopefully still do. And he is or was an associate of the Centre for Applied Cross-Cultural Research at Victoria University. Yep. Feeling a spiritual calling, he became the founding city missioner in Palmerston North, and I think that was on the 18th of February 2024? 23. Oh, okay, the announcement came out in 24. Okay, his mission focuses on supporting, empowering and advocating for change. He promotes, and this is where the food aspect comes in, he promotes cooking classes, community food projects and cultural connections. He identifies as an Italian Kiwi, calling New Zealand his true home. So I leave the floor to Franco.
Thanks, Stuart. Kia ora, everyone. It's really good to be here to share part of what I do, but also my interest in food, not only eating it, but the other aspects of it as well. So I'll just start with my pepeha. So tēnā koutou katoa. Emihi ana aho ki te iwi kāinga, ki te rangitāne, ko I tāgea te whakapaparanga mai, engāre ko Āwherika ki te tonga te whenua tupu, ko te papayoia te kāinga, ko aho te manutake mo te mihana o papayoia, ko Franco Vaccarino tōku ingoa, nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. So the first thing I'm going to get you to think about something is, when you think of food, what comes to mind? So just tell the person next to you the first thing that comes to mind. 30 seconds. Laughter. So I would like to just. Does anybody want to share what came to mind?
Getting fat.
Oh. I wouldn't even think about that. No. Any other one?
Hotter the better.
Oh right, hotter the better. Right. Okay.
You mean chili?
Anything else?
How people cook.
How people cook?
I love food that other people
cook. Oh right, yeah. It always tastes better, doesn't it? Right, right. So the next question is food more than just food for survival, fuel for survival?
Yes.
So food actually serves two key functions, and both are equally important. The first one is a biological function, nourishing our bodies, and the second one is a social function, bringing people together. So food plays a vital role in every culture, more than just nourishment. It brings people together, expresses identity, and carries traditions from one generation to the next. Rooted in our cultural identity, food reflects our history, values, and shared heritage. So, you all know about UNESCO, and they have a section that is called the Intangible Cultural Heritage, and food is recognized as an element of intangible cultural heritage, a way of life that is shared and passed from one generation to the next. So traditional recipes, cooking methods, and dining customs often express the values and beliefs of different communities, making them an important part of cultural heritage. So the UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage has included many dishes from many parts of the world. But I do have to announce that on the 25th of December, Italy received UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage status for its entire culinary system, becoming the first nation to have national cuisine recognized.
Yeah, yeah.
And this designation honors not just individual dishes, but the rich traditions, social rituals, and intergenerational sharing of food that bring people together around the table. So the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, said that for us Italians, cuisine is not just food, not just a collection of recipes. It's much more. It's culture, tradition, work, and wealth. I thought she summed it up quite nicely. So I did a bit of a research on what others have actually said about what food actually means to them from a cultural point of view. So we have May Parker, and she says that my memories of my kitchen back home in Malaysia were always full, not just of aromas, but of people. My grandmother grinding spices by hand, aunties yelling out cooking instructions, and the clatter of plates. Food was more than dinner, and I love this. Food was our culture in a plate on a plate. And we often don't realize that. What we eat, how we eat, is never just about food. It's about who we are, where we come from, and how we connect with others. Food carries stories, traditions, and the shared human experience baked right into every bite. And this was from Kaya Tibble in Aotearoa. When we talk about kai, or food, two things stick out for me. Hononga, which is connection, and manaakitanga, to look after and hospitality. These concepts are central to the role kai plays across iwi, hapu, and marae. Feeding and nourishing people is the core expression of hospitality and mana in the Maori culture. Then I discovered this interesting expression. There is bread and salt between us. And I've never actually come across this. Has anybody ever heard of this expression? So it's an ancient expression that's in a lot of the Slavic, Middle Eastern cultures. And it actually, its meaning varies, but it generally refers either to a deep bond of friendship and loyalty between people, or to the tradition of offering bread and salt as a gesture of welcome and hospitality to guests. So here we see when the Biden family visited Russia, they were actually presented with bread and salt.
I wonder what Trump
is
presenting.
I'm not too sure. They haven't revealed yet, right? Good thinking, right? So this in Mandarin is Nishi Lemang. And when you translate it, or the meaning is actually, how are you? So you see somebody and you say, Nishi Lema. But actually what it means literally is, have you eaten? which I think is a really good way of doing things, right? So the reason is that Chinese people place a high value on the well-being of culture, of others. This greeting is a traditional and cultural expression of care. In Chinese culture, food is strongly connected to emotion, comfort, and survival. And this was interesting. Historically, China faced many periods of poverty and famine, so making consistent access to food a primary concern. And you would actually meet somebody and say, have you eaten? And it's just become a norm, right? So asking Nishi Lemang is a way of checking to ensure you are well, safe, and not hungry. So McIntosh said that people eat food, not nutrients. And we generally see the substances we ingest through the lens of culture and social relationships. So food is more than just survival. It's a way for people to gather, to connect and build relationships. Food plays a role in celebrations, commemorations, and caring for others. It's central to rituals and cultural practices, and we'll have a look at some later. Food helps create a sense of belonging and identity within a specific group. Food is a powerful way to express cultural identity and community values. Food supports the development of shared norms, traditions, and values. And food helps build connection between generations. So are there foods that you only eat on special occasions? So 30 seconds to chat to the person next to you. What foods do you eat that you only eat on special occasions? That they eat at certain times of the year or certain celebrations?
Christmas food.
Christmas food, yeah. Okay.
New Year's Eve.
I said birthday cake.
Birthday cake, yeah. So just going back to New Year's Eve and Christmas, often we have traditions that are passed down from our parents. It just becomes interesting when they are the partners are from different cultures. Then which, do you have a bit of both, or do you start a third, or do you have everything, or, you know, it becomes a bit tricky, right?
We have a mixed marriage. I'm Geordie, that's the top end of England. Merle's the Midlands.
Oh, right.
With Christmas cake. Merle eats it at Christmas, and we eat it at New Year.
How interesting. Yeah. And also certain traditions you might start, because I remember my in-laws used to celebrate Christmas on Christmas Eve. So we'd start eating then, and then Christmas Day was just, food was just out there, and you just help yourself. Whereas my parents celebrated Christmas Day, and so it was really a double day of food, which was good, right? But so those are some of the things that we actually, so let's explore this a little bit further. So food plays a central role in celebrations across cultures, bringing people together to share joy, traditions, and flavors. So we'll just have a look at some of them. So this is the galette des rois. Don't know whether you know this one. It's a traditional French cake that's eaten in the beginning of January, on the 6th of January, for Epiphany. And there's normally a little trinket or a fève inside. And whoever finds it becomes the king or the queen for the day. We have challah bread, which is a special bread in Jewish cuisine, usually braided and typically eaten on ceremonial occasions, such as Shabbat and major Jewish holidays, except Pesach or Passover and Yom Kippur. Then we have hot cross buns. When are hot cross buns supposed to be eaten?
Sunday.
So yeah, between sort of the Christmas, the Easter weekend, right? Now they're available from the 7th of January. So I can see sort of the marketing side of this to make lots of money, but it sort of loses that because you can, you know, you rush out, you haven't eaten them for 6 months or whatever, and then by the time you actually get to Easter when you're supposed to eat them, it's like, okay, but there we go. So that's a bit of a disappointing thing, right? So the fondue chinoise is a popular Swiss communal dining tradition, especially on Christmas and New Year's Eve. And then also linked to traditions, for example, the Passover, the Pesach Seder. It's a family ritual meal held to commemorate the Jewish festival of Passover. So there's specific things that you have to do around the table, but there's also specific food. So it's important that the Passover Seder plate is there, and it has certain things, and that's from the Torah, from the religious book. And then also matzah is eaten. It's unleavened bread, and that's eaten during Passover as well because they can't have yeast. Also, kosher certified. A lot of the food has to be kosher. And this refers to food that's prepared in accordance with Jewish dietary laws that are found in the Torah. Then we have Thanksgiving, and you can find turkey throughout the year in the US, but at certain times, it's cooked in a certain way, and there's a specific stuffing, and cranberry sauce, and a special bean casserole that goes with it. And again, it's a celebration with specific food that goes with it. In Italy, we have panettone, which translates as the big bread, and it's a Christmas pudding, cake rather. And then we have colomba at Easter, and it's in the shape of a dove, and so for Easter, this is what we actually have.
A dove.
It's a cake though, you can't eat it. And then we have Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. It's the beginning of November. It's a Mexican holiday, and people prepare calaveras de azúcar, which are colorful sugar skulls, and also they eat pan de muerto. We have Eid al-Fitr. It's a major Islamic festival, marking the end of the month-long sunrise to sunset fasting of Ramadan. So the Islamic faith, they fast for a month during Ramadan, and then the fast is broken on Eid al-Fitr. And then again, there are certain halal foods that go with Islamic faith, and it's intertwined with spiritual, ethical, and communal life, extending beyond your nutrition to represent purity, gratitude, and divine blessing. So rituals often revolve around strict dietary rules and the sanctification of eating habits. In China, Margie and I tried these, didn't we? Yes. So they have the rice dumplings. That's during the Dragon Boat Festival. And that's the only time you actually find them. And then you have the mooncake at the Mid-Autumn Festival. And then you also have the nyangao, which are sticky rice crackers. So again, these only come out as special occasions to eat them. And then this is really interesting. It's the Opatek, or Polish Christmas wafer. And this custom is traditionally observed during Vigilia in Poland on December 24th, so Christmas Eve.
So what is that food made of?
So it's actually a wafer, a very, very thin wafer, just of flour and water. And then they actually have a lot of designs on it, Christmas-related figurines on it. And you sit around the table, and the opalek is passed around. The ritual involves extending good wishes for the person next to you, and then it's passed around. And everybody takes a piece and carries on. It's just part of the... You can't really have a Polish Christmas without having this as well. It's just part of it. Then there's a Spanish tradition of La Doce Uvas de la Suerte. So it's the 12 lucky grapes. And this is on the 31st of December. The thing is to actually have one grape per chime of the 12 o'clock clock. And it just brings you good luck, etc. So Italy is not too far away from Spain. So we don't do this tradition, but we actually, I remember my mother always saying you have to eat grapes on New Year's Day. And you never question these things as a child. You just grow up and you say, okay, New Year's Eve, have two grapes, and there we go. But it's just interesting how some have actually been modified slightly in different countries and different cultures.
When the grapes harvested, of course it's quite...
Yeah, it is, absolutely. But you probably get them from... south of Spain might still get some. It's quite warm. South of Italy is still quite warm. So you might still be able to grow and get them. But probably from South America or New Zealand during their time. Yeah, their trips across. Yeah. So it's important to note that these dishes go beyond nourishment, acting as powerful expressions and carriers of cultural identity and tradition. And I like this expression by Dr. Nara Narendra. There's more to eating than survival. Eating and drinking are a medium through which we gather, socialize, and create bonds. We celebrate, commemorate, tend to one another, and enact our rituals through food. And the next question, who do you usually share your meals with? Just have a chat to the person next to you.
Me.
And if it's your partner, that's all good. But who else is part of your circle of eating? Anybody else or anything else that you share your meal with?
Maybe the dogs.
Dogs, yes. Family and friends, I hope. Okay, good. If not, then I encourage you to invite me to your house so that I can come along and be friends with you as well. So the oldest ritual on earth involves families and groups of people eating together. So at the end of the day, hunters will return home and divide the food for family and friends. So collecting, preparing, and dividing food may have developed kinship and systems, who eats with whom, the language to discuss food, etc. So this process helped people bring people together and helped define their groups, rituals, and their history. So shared meals act as a social glue, strengthening trust and connection. Eating together provides opportunities to socialize and create meaningful bonds. Shared food experiences support the passing down of tradition and knowledge. So meal sharing and culinary traditions are deeply intertwined with social participation and group cohesion. Eating together helps shape social relationships and community ties. Communal meals encourage cultural exchange between different groups as well. So are there health benefits to eating together? So studies show that eating with others, or at least cooking with others, increases endorphin release, it improves mental health, it enhances emotional well-being, it lowers stress levels and promotes better nutritional levels, habits. Research from the University of Oxford has revealed that the more often people eat with others, the more likely they are to feel happy and satisfied with their lives. Some research was done in Australia looking at the psychology behind sharing food and cooking. And we'll see the benefits that they looked at. So 71% said that it helps me feel more connected to my loved ones. 68% said I feel more socially connected when I share meals or cook with others. 68% said it strengthens my relationship with the people I eat or cook with. 67% said it makes me feel happier and more content with life. And 66% said it makes me feel more satisfied in my relationships. So this was an interesting research, prisoner rehabilitation through shared meals. So So this was in the Nordic prison, specifically in Denmark's Storstrom prison. Inmates cook and eat together as part of a unique rehabilitation program. This shared approach, a mealtime culture, builds relationships and responsibility and practical life skills, fosters a sense of community, it encourages positive behavior and cooperation, and helps inmates feel connected to family and society, which I thought was really interesting. So recent consumer surveys indicate that traditional home cooking and shared family meals are increasingly being challenged by the demands of busy modern lifestyles. As work, school, and other daily commitments place greater pressure on life and time, many families find it harder to prepare and enjoy meals together, leading to more reliance on convenient food options. And sadly, fewer families are eating together. So this was from research from 2014. The average American eats one in every five meals in their car. One in four American eats at least one fast food every single day. And the majority of American families report eating a single meal together less than 5 days a week. So the focus here is on fast food. And as we start and turn our eyes to the fast foods that inundate us constantly and speak to us and tell us how amazing it actually is. So in 1921, in Kansas City, a little place opened White Castle System. And they started with burgers. And it was like a takeaway thing. And it was really the beginning of the burger revolution, or the fast food or the takeaway revolution. The first McDonald's restaurant opened in San Bernardino in California in 1940. So that's quite a while ago. And we're pleased to know that the New Zealand's first McDonald's opened in Porirua in 1976. So in September, we celebrate 50 years of McDonald's in New Zealand. I see some smiles, and I also see some maybe not such a great thing to say. But anyway, let's have the next question is, how has fast food changed how we socialize? Just a quick minute to the person next to you.
It's easier to order and
affordability, but I do contest that because I don't actually think it's that cheap anymore. But anyway, and then you look at how much, let's say a family of four or five to get all burgers and all things like that, how much that costs, and surely you can actually make a really good meal with that. But anyway, we won't get too stuck on that. Also consistency. So wherever you go, a burger's a burger, and you know the menu, even if it's in a foreign language, you can still point to the burger that you want, right? So fast food has steadily become a dominant force in modern life, reshaping not only how people eat, but how they connect with one another and perceive the role of food in their daily lives. fast food has shaped new forms of social interaction and cultural practice, becoming a convenient setting for gatherings and celebrations. So at McDonald's, you can, for example, still have birthday parties, and that's super exciting. It's still social. It's still connecting with others. Families still go along to McDonald's and have a meal together. And so, you know, if they're sitting at home and chatting and they're in a fast food outlet, you know, it's not that bad, is it? But let's wait. Wait, there's more. So the globalization of fast food has adapted to local tastes, giving rise to unique, culturally influenced offerings. So, for example, around the world, with McDonald's, we have these options. You notice the Kiwi burger is there. It's not available in many other parts of the world. And we have this as well. So now, if you've been to Venice, when you come out the train station and you go down the stairs, there's a canal there, and on the other side there's this amazing building. And it's actually Burger King. Probably the most beautiful building, Burger King building, right? And I went inside, it's just amazing. I don't know if it's an 18th century or 19th century building, just beautiful inside. Then when you go and have a look at the menu, it has a traditional Whopper and plant-based, but it also has on the left bottom the Parmigiano Reggiano, so the Parmesan burger with big chunks of Parmesan on it there. And then what's also quite unique is the toast, prosciutto cotto is ham, and so Italians love toast, and so this is actually a little menu for little kids as well. So kids don't get burgers, but they'll get the little toast thing as well. So slightly adapted to fit in. I think somebody said their favorite food is pizza. I do agree with you, absolutely. So the pizza originated in, I think, in 1860-something in Naples. So a pizzaiolo, a man who makes pizza, made a special pizza for Queen Margherita, who was visiting Naples at the time, and using the three colors of the Italian flag, red, white, and green, created this. And that's the original Italian pizza as such. Then we have some variations like the Hawaiian. So when my Italian aunties visited and I introduced them to Hawaiian, I said, how can you actually put fruit on a pizza? I mean, it's just, is it okay to do that? They were very gracious and they actually did try a little bit. Then we also get pizza with wedges. So again, a double of carbs, right? And then we get fusion as well, butter chicken pizza. So next time you go to Domino's, you can order that, right? But then the ultimate is bacon and egg pizza. So from the original top left, it's constantly undergoing changes, right? Credit to the fast food industry as well. They are looking at healthy alternative fast foods and also dietary requirements as well. More introducing gluten-free options, dairy-free options, etc. Okay. This also applies to some of the, I know this is about food, but coffee is sort of connected. So a lot of the major ones as well have broken into many markets as well and have changed things quite significantly. So just going back to Venice again, restaurant chains not only affect eating habits, but they also influence the traditions and habits in countries where they are located. So Starbucks causes cultural concerns in Italy because of the association that Italians make between coffee and leisurely sidewalk cafes. So coffee in Italy is more than a drink. It's part of the way of life. Whilst in many countries it's common for people to buy takeaway coffee, to drink it on the street or back in the office, in Italy people usually prefer to either relax and sit down, or you just stand at a little table and you just enjoy that and you have a chat to those around you. And then the crazy thing about that is here we're so used to paying beforehand
And then when you go to Italy, you pay afterwards. And my daughter, who is this one over here, she has actually walked out of a Resso coffee place without paying. And then when she was at school, she suddenly realized, oh my gosh, I didn't pay. So she ran back and actually paid. So we'd often say to people, just remind us we are foreigners, that if we walk out, you can chase us. It's okay. And coffee shops in Italy offer a personal, friendly atmosphere that many Indians believe a large chains like Starbucks cannot actually provide. So you may have heard of this term, McDonaldization. So a book's been written by sociologist George Ritzer, who coined this term as well. So he says that the principles of the fast food restaurant are coming to dominate more and more sectors of American society, as well as the rest of the world. McDonald's has expanded to over 40,000 restaurants worldwide and continues to expand. So McDonaldization is a result of globalization and ultimately leads to global uniformity, influencing local habits and traditions. And a lot of people who travel, you might arrive in Venice in the evening and you're tired, your Italian's not sort of, you haven't brushed up on your Italian, and you then see a McDonald's and you think, well, at least I'm safe and I know what I'm eating, and so you try that out. And so it does actually impact on you trying actual local foods as well. So this was an interesting article. The food identity of countries differs between younger and older generations. So the abstract is, current generations have been strongly influenced by mass communication and massive immigration flows, which may change local lifestyles and perceptions of inhabitants towards traditional foods and beverages. TFBs constitute a core element of the cultural identity of a country, although some of them are losing their appeal. So a question to ponder on, how are modern foods shaping the way we eat, live, and understand our cultural identity? We return for a second to fast food consumption. So the speed at which fast food is prepared and consumed has influenced traditional food cultures, reshaping the way people eat within society. And this was a research that I found by Culture is Built on a Plate. And they said, if we came to rely on junk food or fast food for survival, what would that mean for our culture? There can be more culture in your plate than you'd ever imagined. Then another impact on food has been the digital age. So the rise of digital ordering apps and self-service kiosks reduces the need for human interaction. So you no longer need to actually say, I'd like a burger with whatever. You're just going to do it on your app, you pay for it, you stand in the queue, they call number 62, and then you go and collect it. You don't even have to say anything. So that can be a bit problematic in terms of social interactions, especially in Italy, where you're expected to actually talk quite a bit while you're ordering your coffee. Then, of course, we also have the mobile phone, which is absolutely amazing. It has revolutionized everything, and it's a really excellent device. However, but before we go to however, so it's great. They're sharing a meal together, right? It's fantastic. But they're not even talking to each other. And that's not just there, it's just so, even a romantic date out, or first date out, unless they're texting each other how amazing they are. So again, that's impacting significantly on things like that. So how are mobile phones shaping our eating habits and our social connections at the table? And I know some families have banned cell phones at the table, kids can't take them in, etc., etc. But the minute they leave home or are with their friends, they're all on their phones. You just almost have to be, right? So you might be asking, what does this have to do with city mission? And that's a good question. But first of all, as I mentioned earlier, I do love food. And I do have amazing memories of the social components of food growing up. Lots of Italian families would get together really often, and we'd have an amazing meal. And inevitably, when we finished our food, we'd move the tables out the way, and we'd put some music on, and we'd dance or we'd sing. So that was almost a given. You couldn't just go and have a meal at somebody's house. There was something missing if you didn't do a little bit of dancing or some more social stuff. So City Mission, we actually like to connect people. So we have programs and activities, but it's not just to come along and do the program, but it's to connect with others as well. So just an example, we have exercise classes and twice a week, and we have people that come along, and then they stay after the class, they actually stay on. And now we actually offer tea and coffee or refreshments afterwards, because people do want to just sit down and have a chat. It's not just about getting fit or staying fit, but actually just connecting with others as well, which we think is really important. Christmas Day, we hosted a lunch at City Mission with two other community organizations. And that was really amazing how we just... With volunteers and everything, we just created an amazing space for people to connect with. And this thing actually says it all at the bottom. It says, Palmy Community Christmas Meal brought connection, kai, and community love. And I think that was it. We didn't want it just to be a place where you just hand out food and go and find a place and sit down, but actually it was more about connecting as well. We had amazing volunteers, and we actually had... more than we actually anticipated. And so some would walk in and say, oh, I see everybody's busy in the kitchen, there's no place for me. And we said, go and actually sit at the tables and talk to people. And then they were like, oh, okay, if I have to, sort of type of thing. That's not really volunteering, you have to really work hard. And then at the end, they said they didn't realize that how important that actually was. It's not just about preparing the meal, dishing it up, and cleaning up afterwards, but it's actually engaging with people. We had quite a few rough sleepers as well, who actually couldn't come in. They just felt too much anxiety to come in and sit down. So we dragged the table out, and they just sat there, and we had volunteers going outside and chatting to them. And so for them as well, it was just more than the food, it was actually the connection to others. We started a Marikai, or a community little garden. And again, you know, you can come and grow your veggies there, etc. But we're looking at growing veggies and friendships. So we, you know, when people come along, we're trying to create a space for people just to sit down and connect with each other, rather than just coming along for the veggies. As Stuart mentioned, cooking classes, we, again, it's not about just coming along, learning the skill, and going home. It's about coming along, learning the skill, sitting down together, and eating the meal and sharing it together, and then actually taking the skills home. So what is the power, the social power of food? So food connects us, food shapes us, food carries our traditions, and food brings us together. So just before we close, I just wanted to remind you there are three other series. Next Wednesday we have Chris Love from Recap. The week after we have Rebecca from Food Rescue, Just Zilch. And then we have Maury on the 27th. So we'll stop for a cuppa, and then we have any questions afterwards. Thank you very much. Thank you. Sitting down and sharing a meal, that could work. Contacting friends as well, so you share the cooking load as well. So you visit a friend and they cook, and then the next time they come to your house, could actually start a small group as well, maybe three or four or five of you who are interested in cooking but on your own, and actually you meet a bit more regularly. Yeah. Are there any other ideas that anybody might have?
A neighborhood dinner.
Yeah, neighborhood dinner. And again, connecting with those close to where you live. Yeah. Any other ideas?
Sometimes you could go and eat in a cafe if you like.
Oh, yeah, if you go to the cafe every night, you'll meet people. But unfortunately, you might find people on their phones. Stuart had reminded me that before the cell phone, we can't always blame it so much, the TV as well got in the way. And so TV dinners as well. Also, when that started, I know when we got TV for the first time, we got super excited on a Friday night. We'd sit in front of the TV and watch. And then it becomes twice a week, and then it becomes four times a week, and then it becomes... That's your new dining area, you know. Is that okay or not? It depends. I mean, everybody can make their own decision, but it's good to actually have that social connection with others. Yeah. Another question is, compared with housewives of our childhood, modern housewives aim to work faster, to make faster meals, cook faster meals at home. So that has changed as well. You can actually, obviously if you get home and at 5:36 and then you still have to start cooking a meal that maybe used to take a lot longer, you try and find foods that are a lot easier to cook or quicker to cook. My grandmother, my dad's mother, used to get up in the morning, send the kids off to school, and she would start cooking the bolognese sauce for dinner, and it would simmer the whole day. And so when my parents got married, my mother had sort of very high my dad had very high expectations of my mother, who was working at the time, and she said, well, don't expect that, right? I know people actually cook like on a weekend as well, get the children to help as well, and then they just prepare for the week and try and prep as much as possible so when you get home. In Italy, they're not very keen on fast foods. So very entrepreneurial people have set up little shops where you just phone and you say, I want ravioli or fettuccine with this sauce, and then they make it for you fresh, and then at night you just drive past and pick it up, which is a very clever idea. So you're still getting that really fresh food with fresh sauce. So that's maybe something if somebody wants to start a business. But that is a reality, unfortunately.
We do have modern appliances now, like microwaves.
Slow cookers as well, absolutely, that you can start early in the morning. It's just about planning, I suppose, but it's still, if you are rushed and having to do, I think children also do a lot more today than when I was in school. If I couldn't get there on my own, my parents weren't going to take me. And so now I find a lot of parents picking the kids up, dropping them off, picking them up and going to another thing and dancing and music and everything, which is all great, but that takes a lot of time from the parents as well. Ideas for sharing meals without the stress of conditioned, it has to be fancy.
The bottom first, I think.
Over
time, many people on their own feel less confident in cooking for others, so it's easier to avoid asking people around for dinner. Do you have ideas for sharing meals without the stress conditioned that it has to be fancy?
So does food have to be fancy though?
No.
I mean, a really good, basic, healthy dish doesn't actually have to be very fancy. But I think sometimes, we're going to so-and-so's house, I need to make something really fancy. Whereas actually, maybe just start a movement. In Italy, there is a movement. It's called the slow food movement. Going back to actually the basics again and actually saying we don't need all this fast food. We need to cook it slowly or put it in a slow cooker or something like that and go back to basic foods as well as opposed to sort of more fancy dishes that have come out. Of course, on the internet as well, if you're a food blogger or you have your recipes, you want to make something different. And so you find all these tweaks to dishes, and sometimes you look for a dish online, a recipe online, and it's got so many ingredients. And you just think, well, that's going to take me 2 days to actually go shopping and then put it all together and prepare it. And so that could take too long as well. So maybe going back to basic recipes as well. What are your thoughts about food as entertainment? Example, cooking shows on TV. How do these affect the ways in which people perceive food? Good question. So, does anybody watch cooking shows?
No.
No? I suppose there as well, Sam is cooking recipes as well. They're just such a variety. And sometimes it is very sort of complicated food as well. So at City Mission, about to launch a YouTube cooking channel where we have some basic recipes. And we've said to, so they're not chefs, so really it's just ordinary people cooking. And we've said make a budget-friendly nutritional meal without using fancy appliances. Because it's quite easy to say, well, just pop this in the blender and then you put it out. Well, I don't have a blender. Or just mash this through here. Well, if you don't have that, well, you just switch off. You don't do it. So it's really looking at, you've got your potatoes, how are you going to mash that with a fork? You know, so again, go back to the basics and showing some people how to actually, you can still cook really good meals without necessarily having to be very fancy or following some recipes that are very difficult to follow. Or not difficult, but a bit more complicated. Oh, then the effect of cell phones. We did have TVs before cell phones, so that could have been an impact as well, yeah? Concern about standardization of food worldwide? Yeah,
you said with the fast food.
Aren't we benefiting from increased diversity as well? Absolutely. So I do agree with the diversity thing, absolutely, and it's really good. Even in Palmerston North here, we have a really huge selection of places to go to if you want to try a different cuisine, different type of food. But that I think is okay. But it's I have a bit of a problem with the big fast foods just almost taking over. But I definitely promote the different groups of people. And it's good to see how other people eat as well, and using chopsticks maybe. Margie and I tried chopsticks, didn't we? So we were in China years ago, and we were in this little restaurant. They put us in the corner because we couldn't eat with chopsticks. And then we had almost finished, and everything was everywhere, noodles everywhere. And then this little girl, she must have been about 4 or 5, and she just came along and stared at these people trying to eat all. And she had a good laugh, and it's like, oh, how do we explain to her that we don't actually use? And she was just using her chopsticks quite quickly, wasn't she? Yeah. So it's just trying different foods without necessarily, instead of another McDonald's, I'd rather see another different cuisine here rather than another fast food. Yeah. Are there any other questions from the floor at the moment?
Tell us more about the food.
Okay, so where we get our food. So we're an emergency food bank, so we don't actually run like the Salvation Army or the Methodist Social Services. So our foods are donated, often through All Saints Church. And others make a donation, or we actually apply for grants as well. Yeah, that's where we get our food from. Yeah. Anybody else?
Do you cater for different eating habits, like vegans and vegetarians?
No, not yet. We intend to move into that as well. Yeah. But yeah, good point. Absolutely.
Basically, I wanted to have a big shout out for Mata Riki, which is family and friend traditions something that we've missed very much in New Zealand, something they've learned.
And it's great. Mike and I were talking earlier that her family and friends have actually started a tradition around Mata Riki, which is actually really great. So as opposed to just, oh, it's just another day, why don't you actually make it a special day of celebration, and then you can actually create your own dishes around that suit your family and your friends. Yeah, cool. Good idea, Mike. Thank you.
I'm not sure if this is a rhetorical question or not, but with eating out in restaurants, if they feel they've got to give you something special, are you getting a balanced diet when you eat out?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Depends, I suppose, on what your body accepts or doesn't accept or rejects. But yeah. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
And one of the social and cultural aspects of food in New Zealand that I'm totally impressed with is the Mariah when it comes to emergencies, how they jump in and will feed anybody without any questions.
It just happens, doesn't it? Just
stunning situation.
People just get together and just, yeah, absolutely. So a really great example of the social and cultural, absolutely.
What was said to be that cooking in the house was woman's work.
Right.
I think that's changing a lot now these days, or is it just my family?
No. It is changing. So you started cooking, right?
I have to. I don't want to do it on my own.
No, there definitely has been a change, and more and more. And because when I was at school, we couldn't do home economics or cooking classes. That was just for the girls.
Yeah.
The boys had to go do woodwork. Boys couldn't do typing. We had to do metalwork or whatever the division was. And then you just think, well, why? You know, when you leave home and you go flatting or you go working or you go traveling and you have to make your own food, if you have no idea how you actually put a few ingredients together, it can actually be really tough. So it's really encouraging that so many of the schools here actually have cooking for the whole class, for everybody, regardless of who they are. And although they might sort of say, at the time, but when they actually get to have to prepare it on their own, it becomes a reality. That they can actually, they do have the skills that are there, at least they've been taught that, yeah. And more and more families as well, I hear that, just the other day I heard somebody saying, my son cooks on a Wednesday night. And just more basic, because he's just learned at school, but at least it's a start, you know, building that confidence. Because sometimes watching somebody else, it looks really easy. Until you start it yourself, it's like, oh gosh, that's not that easy, right? But yeah, it's good that everybody learns from it. Absolutely. Yeah. Good point, thank you.
Just one observation that I'd like to make too is also the hygiene of food. Yes. As people have not learned when they were younger or know, it's very easy for someone who has no knowledge of cooking to perhaps chop a chicken and then go and chop the tomatoes or the potatoes on top of the board. There is a lot to know about cooking, but please don't let people be put off.
Absolutely.
It's very easy to learn,
and that's all part of the learning process before you actually get to make the meals. Absolutely, good point, thank you.
Hi everyone, I'm Chris Vandercott, the chair of the U3A in Manawatu. So it falls to me this afternoon to, on your behalf, to thank Franco very much for what I think was a wonderful introduction to the series. I love the way you started off very, very broadly and narrowed the focus down. This was like a good essay.
It makes it too long, right?
Yeah. No, he's got the technique down to a fine art there. So thank you very much. You've given us all a lot to think about, and some of the issues that you've raised we'll pick up in the future. And thank you for announcing the rest of the series. That's very good. Also, on the back table, if you want to learn a bit more about the city mission, there is a bunch of pamphlets there, so you're welcome to pick those up as you leave. So, thank you very much, Franco. We really appreciate your coming to talk to us.